This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 16th of August, 1961. The title of this lecture is Unknown, Cyclic Aspect of Goals. This tape is 85 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
This is the 16th of August, AD 11, and the subject of today's lecture is Unknown. By the way, there's a letter up in Susie's basket, and there's an unstamped letter up in there, both very important. So let's make sure we get them tonight in the mail. It's very important. One has to do with boats, and the other with photography. People get the idea that I don't do my job. Actually, they believe probably now that I'm never going to write this book about SOP goals clearing. And you'll notice that I wanted a prehab scale complete before that, and I was not satisfied with our prehab scale. I didn't think it completed its evolution. And sure enough, we have various levels on the prehab scale. Your prehab scale actually should have no motion taken off of it and problem put in its place. And all of the emotions which have ever been listed, any emotion which has ever been listed at any time, in any scale, any place, goes in the prehab scale, ending with hide. Hide is an emotion. It's the bottom of the prehab scale. It isn't really the bottom of the prehab scale. Unconscious is below that, but try and run it. Into your prehab scale, pour the whole knowingness scale, which ends in hide. Bottom of the knowingness scale is hide. Bottom of the emotional scale is hide. And these two things come down in a parallel and suddenly turn into a V at the bottom. Interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But there's where the emotional scale and the knowledge scale cross at hide. Knowledge becomes an emotion when one hides. If you don't believe it, watch somebody who knows something that somebody is after him to find out. He's actually not registering any other emotion than hide. And it's a bad emotion. I mean, it's uncomfortable. And that is why your security checks work so well. All right, there's one more item here, and that is the organizations are about to get a security check, which is a security check, and I'll go into this very rapidly. It is security check Form 7A and Form 7B, HCOWW Security Form 7A and HCOWW Security Form 7B. And these are the pair which will be making their debut very shortly. And you should be aware of the fact that those two security checks now all by themselves are run without clearing. They have two different purposes. One is for employment with an organization, and that is 7A, and one is for the person who has been on staff for some time. Yeah, that is right. 7A is for the person who has been around for a long time, and 7B is for the one who is newly seeking employment with the organization. I better clear this up with you, because you say, well, Ron never said anything about that when you get home, and you have an argument of some kind or another, so I better clear it up right away. Those things are used just like the original security check was used. We don't now have a valid security form which is used for its original intent and purpose, or is used the same way. They've all moved over into processing, and you can clear any of them. So 7A and 7B, luck or unluck, the word seven, indivisible prime number, is an uncompromising check. It's easy to remember because seven is a sort of a non-mathematical, non-factorable number. Non-compromising. It takes only about 10 minutes to do one. It is very short. I have only about 20 questions. Those questions are all blood questions. They would be the kind of a thing that if the fellow did that kind of a thing, you wouldn't want him in the central organization. You got the idea? So you read it for instant read, and you just start at the top and you go to the bottom. And if the needle falls, he's failed it. The only other precaution you would take would be a compartmentation of the question. And if the needle is falling on it, obviously not on some of its component parts, that's it. The security check is plunked. That's the original approach. But now that you know about instant read and latent read on a security check, this makes all the difference. Now it's only instant reads that plunk. This is not one of the questions, but do you make a habit of getting your fellow staff members fired by spreading tales about them or something like that? See? All right, instant read, bang, happens right now. That's it. You don't clear it. You find out if the needle is falling on the question, but you don't clear the question. You don't want to know anything from the person you're administering that check to. You don't want to know a thing. It's just totally between you and the e-meter. If it falls, that's it. He's had it. It's a matter of get audited. It's a matter of this, a matter of that. But he has flunked a security check, and it's an insecure personnel. But remember, this check can only be that savage because it only has vital things which would get the organization or its staff members in trouble if this person were consistently doing them. You understand? And so, therefore, it hasn't any fog questions to it. So when doing this thing, don't go adding any variations to the questions. That's the other rule it goes with. Don't go varying this thing around as though you were clearing the question. See, if it falls on that fact, that is it. And don't now ask parallel, rephrased questions of some kind or another in order to get a better read or something like that. Now you can compartment the question. Now you know what I mean by compartmenting the question. You read it phrase by phrase and find out that it's falling on beautiful women. You see, it has nothing to do with the rest of the question. It just falls on beautiful women. It falls on staff members, but it doesn't fall on, you make a habit of getting other staff members in trouble. It doesn't fall on any parts of it except staff members. Staff members falls. Well, it's not part of your security question, so you go on. He didn't plunk it. It didn't fall on the question. It fell on staff members only. You do that by reading the various phrases of the thing and finding out what part it falls on. Because it is true that if you read a full question and get an instant reaction, bang, like that, immediately after you read the thing, that one of two conditions can obtain. And condition one is that the person is simply falling on the question. Meaning he has beaucoup withholds, himself in person, instant read, you see. Latent read, that's for somebody else, a closely associated question, something else, but you've got just your instant read, falls on that, that's it. On number seven, that just flunks the person getting the security check. All right, now, the second way that this thing could fall, as you already know, is do you make a habit out of getting your fellow staff members in trouble? You watch that needle each time. Is it falling on one of those phrases independently? Well, if it's falling on a phrase independently, the next time you read the question as whole, it'll fall on the question or not, as the case may be. Don't you? You can clear that thing up, in other words. But it won't fall on the question of a whole once you've compartmented it. So if it falls just on some part of the question and doesn't fall on the question as a whole on the reread, of course that's not plunk. Do you see how that is? Has the cat ever PDH'd you? You think that's all right? And you'll notice that after you've taken a question to pieces and asked its various parts, the person associates well enough on the question that it's only if the question itself is true as a whole that you'll get an instant read after reading it. You just look a little fogged on it. How do you feel about that? Seem all right? Now, are there any questions about 7A, 7B? Yes?
Just to clear it, Ron, you take, once you've compartmented the question, you find it is coming, falling on a compartment. When you read the question again, it will then null if there is no fall on the question itself.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay. This 7A, 7B be useful for organizations. And it would be if you went security checking for an organization or something like this, you would use form 7A, 7B. You wouldn't use any other form. You wouldn't use old form 3 or something like that. In other words, you could do a person in 15 minutes. You can do one of these things almost as fast as you can read. Because the instantaneous character of the reactive mind is not fully appreciated by you yet. Fully appreciated. It's quick. It's quick. It's wrong, but it sure is quick. There's a basic definition of the purposes of the reactive mind in Book 1. I've never had any reason to change that. It's a mind that acts without the person having to inspect. And so all of its content is uninspected. So the person has to himself have conceived that he himself is inadequate before he develops a reactive mind.
I have a question. You said fall. You said if the question fell.
Reacted.
Reacted.
Reacted. Okay. You're running into the colloquialism of, you say a needle fall, you mean a needle motion. It's a carelessly used phrase, and it's just been too long that we only thought they fell, you see. I'm sorry. You shouldn't use fall. Don't do as I say. Do as you're supposed to do. I say fell carelessly. Reacted. But let me tell you something. As far as this goes, you will only get falls. Fall is also correct. When you've got a fellow who's guilty on the line, you won't find any theta bops or anything else on the thing. It goes pow! I don't care if he's security checkable or not security checkable or anything else. You ask it with good intention, and it hits right in the middle of the reactive bank. It'll re-stimulate, and it'll get a fall. Now, there's a liability on all security checking. Person has to be up to having some responsibility of some character or another. Otherwise, you don't get the thing falling as it clears from the reactive to the analytical mind. The reactive mind doesn't fall because it isn't alive. The reactive mind is not alive. The reactive mind has to be energized. An automobile with no fuel in the gas tank goes nowhere. And the reactive mind, without some energization, can't do anything. Now, the fellow could be totally a reactive mind, at which time he'd behave like an analytical mind. You find them in institutions, and you don't find them outside, believe it or not. I mean, a person who is only capable of dramatizing one engram, of course, long since has either kicked the bucket or walked over the edge of the cliff or has been scooped up by the little boys in their white coats with their butterfly nets. There has to be an energizing factor. Now, energy only exists where a person has a bit of responsibility. The thetan is putting out energy. Only a thetan can put out energy. Energy doesn't come from food. A thetan has to think the food has energized him, so he energizes it. Dead tissue is very amazing because you can feed it into motors and engines, you see, and because it then does something. Why people think that when they eat they get energy. That's quite interesting. The body is a carbon oxygen engine that runs at a temperature of 98.6, just like a gray diesel runs at 185 F. You see, I mean, it's the same deal. But the difference is that a diesel runs when the engineer has left the engine room. But a body doesn't. So it is not a total engine. See, this is actually a different kind of engine. A It requires somebody around at the crank who is pretending the engine is running. And the fellow is around at the crank, and if he grinds the crank fast enough and doesn't notice that he's grinding the crank fast enough, then he thinks the engine is running. And he's very happy about it. But it's not really quite an engine. It follows all the rules of an engine. You know, it requires fuel, and it runs on heat, and it furnishes motive power, and everything is just fine, but it won't run after the engineer's left the engine room. And it just goes, loomp, bump. You should see some of these big, great big steam generator plants that the logs been building in the old days. Boy, they were Rube Goldbergian things to end them all, you know. Great big steam generators, triple expansion, Curtis steam turbines, you know, and boy, they were running at a high scream. I don't know what they made, 17,000 RPM or something like this, and reduction gears went down, and it turned great big generators, and huge cables ran out the switchboards. Boy, marvelous. And more gimmicks and gadgets and levers you could pull. And my strongest memory of one of these things is being gotten very cross at one time because I dared whistle in the place, you know. And obviously the engines were supposed to make all the noise. No small boy was supposed to. Anyway, you can walk out of the building, walk around the block, practically take off a weekend. And one of these automatic stoke, preferably an oil boiler sort of thing. This goes on running. You come back, it's running the same rate of speed. Remarkable. You walk out of the place, you walk back in, take a look at it. Yeah, it's still running. Same rate of speed. You exteriorize from body, go past Arcturus, and come back and pick it up, you find its temperature has dropped. And it's very embarrassing, too. I remember down in Europe one time, left body in an inn, and went over and went through a couple of cables and did something and so on, and came back to pick up this body. And by God, they buried it. They just did it. And took all of its accoutrements to pay for the funeral, of course. Terrible. Ah, well, logs. Anyway, now a perfectly good doll body won't do this. You won't get a doll body doing this. Doll bodies either run on power packs and switchboards, at which they're very close to robot bodies. You know, they're self-energized in some fashion or another, or they're hooked up in communications or something of this sort. Or a true doll body. And a true doll body comes as close to this definition of the engine that won't run without the engineer present as you can possibly get. And a true doll body has absolutely no machinery in it of any kind whatsoever. It doesn't have a single cogwheel in it. It is simply a sheath. And you pick it up and make it walk around. And then you put it down and there it is. And of course it's usually made by some of the better metal companies. And the thing doesn't rust or anything like that. You can get it wet, get it dry, and get it ice cold. It's usually quite impervious to temperature. And you can get it at 200 degrees centigrade, and it doesn't go to pieces. And you can get it up to 200 or 300 degrees, minus 200 degrees centigrade, below the pressures when gases turn into fluids. You can get it below that, and it still is all right. And you get it above that, couple of hundred degrees, and it doesn't heat up or jam or anything. And that's a good doll body. That's a real doll. Now, those that get energized and so on have the little cogwheels and the thingamgubbets and the thing where somehow or another you make its head turn and it hits the button over here that makes it go nah, 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 and so on. That's getting in close to robot, but it's a thetan-motivated set of motors. And the thetan furnishes the energy which pours the current through. You get the idea. The thetan, he puts a little energy in, and then the motor puts a lot of energy in. That's helping you out real good. You know? And now those things, because of their electrical connections, and because electricity and so on, tends to have funny things happen to it. And it does have. Electricity does have remarkable things happen to it as a result of temperature. And because it does have resistances and capacitors and things like this in it, it's narrowed the band, you see? It narrowed the band of tolerance, the temperature tolerance, plus and minus, is getting quite narrow. And usually they'll build these things so that none of the cogwheels have to be greased or something like that. But nevertheless, expansion contractions of metal may cause them to freeze and so on. You start getting into trouble with this type of doll body. Move just a little bit further and you've got a robot. And that is a body with no thing in it. And you'll run into these types of bodies on the track. PC sitting in them as valences and that sort of thing. You should have some kind of a grip on the variation of the things. There is the pure doll body, which of course is no machinery, no connections, no nothing. I mean, when you get rid of a doll body, when you take a doll body off, you stand it in the corner, of course it just goes into a bunch of metal. You know, it's just like taking off a dress. You just drop the dress and it goes crunch. And it's not even stiff. Then there's, of course, the one that has the machinery that helps you out and narrows the tolerances. And then, of course, there's the robot. And then, of course, there's the biological body. And that is something that helps you out enormously. And it is a cousin to this middle type of body that's got the machinery in it and the gimmick, the hoojits and the gill hoolies and the junk. And its tolerance, because it's biological, is so narrow as to be frightening. It is fantastic. I mean, it's lack of tolerance of temperatures and lack of tolerance of velocities, lack of tolerance of impacts and so forth. And you try to walk one of these bodies around at 20 degrees Fahrenheit plus, and you'd very shortly be in trouble, unless it's assisted considerably. You see. And you try to walk it around very much at 130 degrees Fahrenheit, and once more, it is in trouble, unless it is assisted enormously. And its band, you might say, is probably somewhere in the vicinity of about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. It's about the only band you've got. Of course, that makes it totally unusable in space travel. It's totally useless. Man will never get off into space, into planets, or anything else until he wakes up on this subject. Now, the way they wake up might also be of interest to you, but they start artificializing bodies. They don't actually suddenly realize that there are thetans and all this kind of thing. They start artificializing pieces of biological bodies. They've done it, doing it now. They put in a mechanical voice into somebody who has no voice, and they put in mechanical hearing and mechanical this and that. And pretty soon some guy will make the sock vaccine discovery of the century, which is a television screen installed back of the eyelids to let the blind see. Oh, this would be marvelous. I can just see the scientists now, the marvels of modern science and so forth. Why don't they do it now? They need a small television camera and a knife and some aseptic surgery. But gradually, why, they displace various parts of the body. And then they go on a very hectic got to survive, and they won't let anybody die. And they're right there right now. We're living right in the early beginnings of this. They must not die. And some bird, half his head's gone, his right leg's been torn off in the accident, and he's going to look like hamburger for the rest of his life. And so the medicos roll up their sleeves, you know, and they put in a silver skull, and they put on an artificial leg, and then they hook the thing up and connect it all up with the crisscrosses so he twitches the nerve someplace or another, and something else doesn't happen usually. And they got it all taped, you see. And well, this is the artificialization process, and this will go on for some time, a century or two. And they'll gradually put more and more gilhoolies and gimmigahoojits and so forth, which are substitutes for the biological parts of the body. And what they're really doing is building this second class of body, not a real doll body, but they're building this second class of body. And eventually they'll get this guy totally rebuilt, you see, and he'll be hardly any biological parts, and then they'll realize that the printed circuit that they have put in it, you know, that is probably what's making it run, and that's very mysterious. But it's probably this, and there'll be some vast theories on it. One of these false sciences will come up on the thing, you know, about the very small energy wavelengths that whirly-gurg around the capacitugs. And you get this all muckled up one way or the other. But this guy is still operative, you see. And he's moved out of the biological sphere, and they'll find his temperature tolerance is now wider. Ah, now there's... Somebody will brighten up and say, well, now if a person were fixed up like that and this sort of a deterioration's gone on, we haven't let this fellow die through 28 accidents and so forth, and he's got no biological left and he's all metal, and so help me Pete, this fellow really will do well in space, and so they fire him off to some planet. And they get up on the moon and it's 200 degrees centigrade one way or the other way, and it freezes up some of his parts, and they keep trying it again, you see, and they keep messing it up and trying it again. And then they get so very interested about the thing, and one day they build one of these things and they omit the printed circuit. Accident, you know. And it functions. This guy still functions. They didn't put the circuit inside the chest, you know. And they still know anything about things, you see. And functions without the printed circuit. So they start fooling around and they start cutting down on the juice of one or something like this, you know, putting smaller and smaller batteries in it or something to make the guy function. And then they find out there's no batteries much, and no printed circuit and no batteries much. And about this time they invent a new religion. It's really God doing all this, you see, some God or another. And science moves straight over, right in that zone somewhere during those medical discoveries, science moves straight over into a wing-ding religious space opera type of existence. Nobody knows what cooks, what's happening, or anything, but they've got it over in the banner, the borderline here. And science is religion, and now you have to believe Newton's laws, and you have to believe this and that, you see, and you're liable to be charged for heresy in the midst of one of the finest chromium-plated courtrooms, you know, with everything going whir-clunk, you know, and teledisc typewriters that take down all of the thing, you know, this, the judges speaking causes the machines to go, you know, and... the sentence is carried out mechanically. The moment that they say guilty, the jury says guilty, why, big fingers pick up the fellow out of the box, you see, and put him on an endless vacuum hoisted express and land him up in a preservation body and pawn type jail, you see. I mean, it's all very modern, you know. Boy, have they got the scientific principles, but the charge will be heresy. See, they've gone the whole circle now. Science, having escaped religion, has arrived right back in the lap of it again, because they don't understand what's happening here without the printed circuit. There's something wrong here someplace. So anyhow, if they last long enough, if this society lasts long enough, they will eventually back out into real doll bodies with a sort of a quasi-religious sort of an atmosphere, you see. Well, all the time they're going up the track of this, and sometimes it takes thousands of years to do this whole evolution, they get back up the track on this thing, and they've only been doing it to a few in the society. And what's this been doing to a handful of Thetans? See? Not very many Thetans. You know, a matter of hundreds or something like this. Well, what's happening to these fellows? Well, they're getting conditioned back into getting familiar with, once more, running a pure doll body. And they're developing this facility. And they don't do it by processing, they do it by familiarization. And they gradually get up into a point where they kind of know what they're doing. They're not very aware. Their ethical level is something that you would sniff at, you see. But here they are. And they can actually, just a handful of guys, and they can run real, honest doll bodies. Not only that, they can step out of one doll body, which has been in a crash, and pick up a new doll body on the assembly line and operate it and say, yeah, my name is John Jones, number 786Z Thrip, and all of a sudden they are a caste, they are a hierarchy, and this hierarchy of a few hundred will go along, and they'll actually run the whole cotton picking shooting match, Because what can anybody do to them? Nothing. Their doll bodies are made out of impervium, and they take a higher tolerance of impact than can be delivered by the normal bullet. You created a doll body hierarchy. And this doll body hierarchy then moves further and further, and then these fellows commit overts as dolls, and commit overts, and commit overts. They still don't know really what they are, what they're doing. And they're all mixed up with God, too, remember. They think they're God's anointed or something. And next thing you know, they lose two or three of them, you see. And then they lose two or three more. And then in desperation, the last five or six or seven or something like this will gang up and say, well, they're not going to do away with us. We're not going to get lost, you see. And then they stand in running some kind of a galactic empire of some kind or another. But they get lost just like anybody else because their overts keep piling up on them. You know? And then they disappear into the track. And that'll be the end of one of these doll body hierarchies. Usually about that time, things have gone so bad and the biologicals are all in a state of super communism, slavery. No, excuse me, communism. And everything is all super socialized so that what's mine is yours is the state's. And nothing is mine, and nothing is yours, and after a while, nothing is the state's either, you see. Try to run a tractor that isn't owned by an individual, a company, or a state. It won't run very long. And the thing comes about then, the final denouement of all of this is, of course, that this folds up by reason of war, lack of management, too involved, goes splooey, bang, and you wind up with a disintegrated galactic society, and then splinters of this society will start making it on their own, and they'll go on an independent evolutionary track. And Earth isn't a splinter of such a group, by the way. Earth was a kind of a territory that was sitting out here minding its own business. It was actually part of the Biological Survey Park Reserves. This had no more importance on the full track than that. That's right. And its current importance is that it might form a bridge into the basic galaxy on the rim of which it sits. But anyway, then these splinters, they'll pick it up. And through the thousands of years and so on, they will gradually start this process once more of medical substitution, mental implantation, fixing up the mechanical voice box, and then somebody finally gets fission going, and then they decide they're going to fire one off into space, and then they find the biologicals can't stand it, and they keep nagging at this idea of getting man into space, sometimes for decades, sometimes for centuries. Then eventually they get a total semi-doll, you know, a doll robot, that's sort of a combo, and they'll find out that that is a form which can go into space. And of course, all these boys all get familiar again with space opera, high blast velocity, weapons, everything else. The whole thing works out. You got a space opera society. You got a hierarchy. Your hierarchy, of course, dwindles down by overt. You got a few left, so you got an empire. And then your empire, the overts get to these last boys. They dissolve, bang, the thing splinters up, and that's the way it's been going. Might be interesting to you in investigating somebody's track. That isn't the only type of evolution there is. But when Darwin was talking about evolution, the evolution which I have just said is a far truer picture of actual evolution than, it was a vast sea, and there was an ammonia sea, and there was a little spontaneous combustion somewhere in it. And the spontaneous combustion was a cell. Isn't that cute, kiddies? And then with other fairy tales, we finally get this thing all built up. The actual facts behind this, you see, are so outrageously different that it makes it very, very funny, you know. Here a bunch of guys sweating like mad around drawing boards saying, what is an optimum zebra, you know? I don't like that. I don't like that design. He's not well camouflaged particularly. What particular type of continent is he fitting on? Well, he's fitting on an X9 continent. Perfectly well designed for an X9 continent. Yes, I know, but an X9 continent doesn't have any red flora. That's true. See? Make them orange. Okay, that's a nice looking zebra. So what? And what's his habitats? And what's his various morale? And what he's supposed to eat? And how is he supposed to congregate? And what's supposed to prey on him? And what's he supposed to keep down? Get it all figured out, great big computers going, you know, make IBM down here look like child's typewriting machine. You know? And these things are going whir, clank, and they finally get a bunch of thetans, and they say, how would you like to be a zebra? here are the advantages of being a zebra. Here's the list of now I'm supposed to's. And you eventually see some thetans around, and they're getting all educated in various directions or another, and being zebras. And they finally get so super educated on the subject of zebras, they can do nothing but zebra. And you got it all made, they got all the now I'm supposed to, they know exactly how to fire this one off and so forth, and so they pack them up and ship them off to X9 type planet. You got zebras. Then somebody slips sooner or later. Somebody skids. Somebody's drawing this thing and so forth, and he's drawing this body, you know. Got it all set. What do you think about that, Joe? Well, I don't like that very much. What's the matter with it? Well, it looks like us. Yeah, well, I know it's a biological. It's us. Biological. Oh, well, got to have a few wogs. There's this problem about what's to keep down lions. You realize that you got lions, and there's nothing keeping down lions at all. All right, well, we'll put a few of them on, make a few of them. All right, okay. Send out this volunteer call. Who would like to be this animal man? Everybody says, you know, it looks awfully like the gods and kings that are walking around here, you know. Gods, kings, and technicians, and other priests. So they say, well, we have a few blue wogs, you know. We'll put a few wogs down on this X9 type planet, and that'll keep down the lions. And we give them a big fixation about lions. You know, they must kill lions. Yeah, that's all right. The only trouble is, this particular lion is too inviting. So the boys, as they get knocked off in other actions and so forth, see these wogs walking down on an X9 type planet, and they pick them up. Of course, but you've got an educated technician running the thing. So you keep your evolution going. Homo sapiens. And every once in a while, one of these societies will get very excited about the idea. Do you realize that that planet there has killed off not only all the lions, but now they're starting on the passenger pigeons, and they're starting on this, and they're starting on that, and they're knocking off all the buffalo and so forth. And do you realize that there's a virus there called Homo sapiens? You realize that? Well, I guess you're right, Joe. I tell you, let's get a couple of fellas and let's gin them in real good on the subject of atomic fission. Mm-hmm. I see what you're hitting at. And there it goes. All kinds of weirdies like this go on. Space opera is actually incredible, but space opera is only one phase of civilization. And it's only one phase of the civilization processes. And of course, these types of bodies are only one small fragment of classes of bodies. There have been bodies, of course, which are just simply spheres. Spheres which can levitate. There's bodies which are triangles. There's bodies in any geometric form. All but based on the basis, the fellow's being nice enough to put up a mock-up to show his location. And on that idea alone, you get the whole idea of bodies. But of course, some fellow that's sitting around on the edge of a cloud and hasn't got a single thing to do and isn't even, well, just bored stiff, you know. Somebody comes along to him and says, how'd you like to run a grasshopper? What's a grasshopper? He's had it. There's his C. There's his C. After it follows his D, and then comes his E, and then comes his I. Of course, they usually make a contract with a fellow like that. And they say, well, after you've been a grasshopper a few thousand years, well, we'll come down and set you free. Then they forget. And you get a revolutionary spirit entering into all this. All the grasshoppers are mad because they've been forgotten. All kinds of wild, oddball aspects to civilization, the making of life, all of it goes down to the basic activities of thetans. They forget things, they remember things, they refamiliarize themselves with things, they plot out vast and intricate civilizations and patterns and so forth. Their desire for complexity exceeds their desire for simplicity, and they get into trouble and then don't know where the hell they are and don't know what they're doing. All kinds of odd circumstances. And out of this tremendous mishmash, why, you get such a thing as this universe and its functions and its distresses and all that sort of thing. But you should know, really, that there are various types of bodies of this kind or nothing. And if you can find a PC now who has a vast allergy to some type of civilization, you've got it made. Got it absolutely made, because he's got a large section of his tract squashed into a knot is. And now you've got the ways and means of releasing a knot is. You've got the not know types of processes, and you can release tremendous knot is's off of this particular section of track. All right, you find somebody, if you were assessing somebody in a calm sort of way, minding your own business sitting there, particularly minding your own business, not inquiring into his, because that would be an invasion of privacy. You get your thetan that's sitting across from you, going along all right, and then he says, well, I always wanted to be a sailor. Yeah, that's goal, sailor, sailor. Now, I'm not telling you to do this, but if you were to say, well, what would that, because this would be a direct invalidation of his goal, but let's follow it, or you're questioning it a little more circuitous. But where would somebody not want to be before he wanted to be a sailor? Any type of things, and of course he's got the Sahara Desert or something, you know, some opposite of some kind. And he said, well, I don't have much to do with this. What's the matter with that? I don't know, it's these planets with no vegetation on them, you know, and that sort of thing. And you say, well, would it make a planet with no vegetation on it? Well, he says, obviously an atomic physicist, but atomic physicist, I guess I just sort of answered it. Yeah, that's right, a planet with no vegetation on atomic physicist. Or, yeah, that's right, atomic physicist. You don't have much to do with that. Well, let's get on to something else. And you say, well, what about this atomic physics? Well, let's get on to something else. It's just not a subject that I have any interest in whatsoever. Now, you run into an impasse like that with a PC, and of course, what have you got? You've got yourself a great, big, massive scrunch of not is. And this goal, by the way, is liable to register highly agitatedly to be an atomic physicist. Of course, is lying behind that, but he can't reach it. You see, the goal is not to be an atomic physicist. And that's a nice, big, whopping negative goal. Now, you start tearing this goal up, well, what could you not know, you see, about this beingness? What could you not know about that type of goal? What could you not know about blasted planets or something like this? And you just see track just suddenly fill in all directions. And all of a sudden, the PC starts getting over his habitual habit patterns. I'm talking about the habit pattern, the PC, and all these. He hates to have headaches, but somehow or another, no matter how much you audit him, he always manages to get a slight headache, you know. And he isn't leading too good a married life, and you audit him, and it patches up his married life much better, but he's really not quite there. It's all these not quites, you see. You'll find all those not quites in that bundle piece of track. And it's scrunched right in there. See? If you want to change somebody's attitudes that he desperately wants to change, find out what he, under no circumstances, the goal he doesn't want to have anything to do with. And then not know that goal to kingdom come. And you all of a sudden will find yourself about the widest section of track. The fellow says, under no circumstances, in Indian society. Say, I don't want anything to do with that. You say, well, in Indian society, you know, Indians and they run around and shoot game and canoes and that sort of thing. Yeah, that's the kind of thing. He said, well, I don't want to do anything to that. Never had any interest in it in my whole life. Not only have I never had any interest in it, I don't want to have any interest in it. That's the point. And you say, well, what part of it wouldn't you want to have any interest in at all? And he says, well, no part of it at all. And you're trying to lead me in, you're trying to trap me. And he was liable to completely kind of lose his head at this point, you know, saying, oh, wait a minute, I'm an auditor too. Now, you're not getting me into that, man. That's it. Now, if you're lucky enough, and I do mean lucky enough, to have singled one of these areas of won't go into's as a class of civilization, behavior, activity, anything like that. If you're lucky enough to have stumbled into one of these things with a case, or if you've wormed yourself into one of these things by your goals assessment, finding out also what he has never had a goal to be, he's liable to tell you with some violence what he's never had a goal to be, which is quite the reverse. You start handling that with not know. Forget. Just crisscross that thing up and down, back and forth, and you will find that all of the PC's fixed behavior patterns, his detestations, his compulsions, his obsessions, the real deep ones, the ones that you're just spinning over the top of, all lie in that exact zone and area. You may not get all of them in one of them. You understand? There might be two or three more open up afterwards, but that first one will be a big payoff because it, of course, opens up other zones. And now that he's licked one zone, if you got him to do it well with your not know and forget and so forth, now he's got courage enough to tackle some of the others. It's a very interesting case entrance, I assure you. It's something. It's, you're real lucky if you get your hands on on one of these in a PC very early in the auditing. Why, you save yourself an awful lot of auditing. Just tear it to ribbons. You know, and you're storing knowledge, knowingness, whatnots, and recognitions, and so on. Look, this is absolutely factual. As close to an absolute as you can get. That which is most aberrative is least known. See, that is true. That which is most aberrative is least known. And if the PC knows something about what is giving him a lot of trouble, it isn't giving him any trouble at all. Now, how do you like that? So much for the PC that comes in with 18 pages of his aberrations. Not his goals, that's all right. But he comes in with 18 pages of his aberrations, telling you that all of his difficulties stem from his early life and his sexual relationships with his sister. File it, man. File it with the greatest of care. Along with his case, file it. Thank him very much, because you don't need to tell him what you're thanking him for. Which is telling you completely and positively that he is now giving you a place where you don't have to look, even slightly. You can just avoid the whole subject from here on out. Obviously, if he knew this much about it and he still looped, that isn't it. You see, that's the test. The test has been fulfilled. If he knew about it, there's something wrong. Got the idea? If you actually were to twist a goals assessment around just into the basis of finding vast zones where this guy doesn't want to go, doesn't want to have anything to do with or otherwise, and explored those zones, you would be doing such fantastic stunts with a case that you would look like a miracle worker. And it would be with speed. You wouldn't be doing any grind on anything. It's rather amusing to watch the speed with which they will try to escape one of these particular areas, and the artfulness with which they'll try to escape, all the time going slam bang into the middle of the area. You can practically the soles of their feet are smoking. They're being yanked back into the area so fast, because it's the one place they postulated themselves out of. So of course it's the one place that is never as-is. So of course it's the one place with a maximum callback. And it's, of course, the one place that they will never confront. So it's the one place they know nothing about. All these things add up. You play this, you could actually do some fabulous things. fellow says, well, I had a goal to be a plumber, and I had a goal to be a fireman, and I had a goal to marry a rich widow. Yeah, I thought that would be a good idea, and I had a goal to do this and a goal to do that. All right, let him go on with his goals. Go right ahead and do your goals assessment. Nobody's telling you not to do a goals assessment as per routine. Right. But he's got lots of goals. 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 Next coordination. The more goals a PC comes up with, the more the PC has tried to escape. From what? And if you just add that little question mark into your auditing, your questioning, your handling of the particular case, yeah, what from what? Now, what would a goal to be a plumber, what would that get you out of? Well, that's an interesting idea. Well, it'd get me out of having to pay plumbers to fix pipes. No pay dirt there. Well, now this goal to be a fireman, what would that get you out of? Oh, that would... Oh, that's something else. Ah, yeah. Of course, you think it'd be to get me out of fires. PC's face getting red, you see. As a matter of fact, that's right, too. I'd completely forgotten about it when I was 2 years old, house burned down. All right, so he's contacted an incident. You going to leave him hung up in this incident forever? Something like that? You've already, by offbeat questioning, got him into this incident. You've already asked him what would be a fireman, what would that solve, or what would that get him out of, and he's handed up to you the confusion. Well, you can run it right out with what could you not know about that, you know, and what have you forgotten about that, and crisscross it up. And you find out that if you're very good, it'll only take 5 or 6 questions to blow the whole thing. So it'd be actually stupid of you not to do so. If you're doing a straight goals assessment and he goes into these things, skip them. But if you're actually the one who's putting him into these things, if you're shoving him into these things and so forth, take them up. That was why I didn't particularly want to talk about that yesterday. But you find out there's very fruitful areas of auditing. This is the biggest open sesame to a whole track on a case you ever wanted to handle. So get so you can handle it. There's another coordination. It's not necessarily the person who has lots of goals is in bad shape, but the person who has had lots of goals has been trying to get out of a lot of things, that's for sure. All right. Now there's another one. Is that person whose memory is the closest to PT, with the rest of it shut off, is the worse off person? You see, a person is as bad off as his memory is only close to PT. Got that as a coordination? It's a rule. That's a good rule of thumb with a case, good case analysis. A person is as bad off as his memory is only exists close to PT. The reverse of that, of course, is the person is as bad off as he is occluded. This actually doesn't have too much coordination with ability, which is one of the odd things. A man can be overcoming by the grit of his teeth a lot of this occlusion and that sort of thing just by, you know, just trying to grit in his teeth and carrying on. But you can expect this fellow to fall on his face sooner or later. He's not going to be happy about it. He apparently has a considerable amount of ability, but with that ability you will find a considerable amount of strain. Now if you suddenly start opening up the track on him and showing him the vast vistas that are closed out to his view and so on, for a little while his strain will decrease. And his doing this will decrease. This is only during auditing, you see. He'll start to say, oh, well, now I can sit back and relax. Now I know what it's been making me. It's just been my aberrations. See, he'll run into the same thing they ran into in psychology and psychoanalysis. It's my aberrations which have been making me do. Now I know. So I don't have to strive anymore, you see. It isn't necessary that I strive. He will sort of start thinking this way and thinking this over, and he looked that over. Of course, that's specious. utterly specious. He strives for an entirely different person, a reason. He strives for interest. He strives to have something to do. He strives to have something to be interested in. He strives to have a game, for God's sakes. That's the obviousness of it. You open up a few more spadefuls of track, and the garden, it looks like, more like garden soil when you first pick it up off the case, by the way, you know, all balled up and dark black, and all tangled up with the roots of yesterday's roses, and start straightening this out, and all of a sudden he starts saying, well, I'm in a very relaxed frame of mind that he can go on and accomplish eight times as much. Now he becomes a dangerous man, a truly dangerous man right about this point, because he, obviously everybody will agree that he's very dangerous because he's in action. They will never assess the fact that he is getting things done, he's helping people, that things are going along fine, and so forth. The fact he's in motion will cause some of the people in his vicinity almost to fall flat on their backs. They will be upset. You can count on this. They will be upset. Now, he therefore has to be in good enough shape so that he can go on doing and not minding all of this upset. So he has to be gotten over the approval button. Otherwise, he will slump as a case. And the approval button is the make-break point of that. And all of a sudden, why he does, his control of the vicinity is so much better. His ability to get on in life is so much improved. His functional characteristics, coupled with, of course, this control of the environment, or his pervasion, you might say, of the environment, and all this damps out. People take a few cracks at him, then they quit. Then they say, maybe we ought to take this up, you know? Maybe something else ought to happen here. And you don't get the backflash. But it all goes back to this idea that of know thyself. And this is one of the oldest wheezes in the field of philosophy. Philosophers have been standing around. You could always count on the fact that a philosopher didn't have anything else to say, and he just received his gold piece or something at Delhi or Egypt or Upper Thebes or Lower Chicago or someplace. And he didn't have anything else to say. He could always reach out his hand, you know, and he'd say, well, son, know thyself. And of course, this poor guy goes out and struggles around. He's not only not got his gold piece, but he keeps trying to look into his bank and look into his life, and there's nobody to help him out. And of course, the more furiously he knows, the more on automatic goes not know. And if these philosophers had just said to the boy, after they'd gotten the gold piece, if they just said, well, son, not know thyself. It would have been a wonderful world. You see, the aberrated person, the truly aberrated person, is really, really worried about one thing. He doesn't know what others are going to do. That is the beginnings. And when it reaches the end, he doesn't know what he is going to do. And that is what worries him. So he gets all kinds of restraints. He uses engrams almost consciously. He uses all kinds of mechanisms to prevent himself from doing things. He does anything he can think of to restrain himself. What is he restraining himself from doing? Well, that question he can't answer. But he can answer this question, that he should. He should. And why should he? Well, because he doesn't know what he is going to do. He doesn't know what he's liable to do. You'll see this in its crudest form, maybe in battle. Men going to wars in earlier days always used to be tremendously concerned about what their behavior in battle might be. I don't know why they were this concerned. For the benefit of some cockeyed king with eight mistresses and a crown cocked over his left eye, he was supposed to go out and open your jerkin and let some farmer from over the hill someplace shove 5 or 6 inches of steel in you. I don't quite see the logic of this, but they are used to anyhow. And I've marshaled up lots of them in line to do just that, so I should criticize. Anyway, this bird, you see, his questions as he starts forming up, you know, and he hears, it was a good idea to join the militia, you see, the girls all loved you, and you got this nice uniform, used to have nice uniforms, don't anymore, but the girls loved you, and you could strut around and make brassy sounds in the tavern, and about that time, you see, you start into the battle, and guy, what am I going to do, you know, what will I do? You know, what will I do? Will I get up there to the line instead of nicely unbuttoning my jerkin? Will I turn and run? You see? And will I defame myself in front of all of my friends? And will I turn out, am I a hero or am I a ready coward, you see? And this becomes very oppressive. Becomes very oppressive. How am I going to measure up? Well, we can see that. I just give you that as a gross example. We can see this big question mark coming up. And so forth, well represented in Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage. But there's another one. How about the guy that goes through life, not only knowing, this isn't the question, is he going to run or is he going to stand there? That's too clear cut. But every day of his life, he's not quite sure how he will behave. You see, he's not quite sure whether he will toe the mark or not toe the mark, or do his job or not do his job, or is he going to cut and run, or is he just going to be sitting there at his desk and suddenly, for some peculiar reason, just break down and start screaming? You know, is he liable to do that? Well, he is. And it begins with the basis of not knowing what others are going to do, you see, and it winds up till he finds out he doesn't know what he's going to do. He just can't trust himself. And in view of the fact that he can't trust himself, why, then, of course, he's sort of got to retire from life. He's got to go further and further back, further and further back. And he can't go any further back after a while. He finds there's a wall there, you know. So he starts bringing the bank in on him, you know, harder and harder. And, of course, the more bank he brings in, the more he's likely to do odd things, of course. And he finally winds up at a total impasse. Doesn't necessarily go mad, but he certainly becomes inactive, and he'll give you long speeches of this character. Well, when I was a young man, I used to have ideas about doing this and that and getting everything done at once. You just announced to him the fact that you're going to buy a new car or something, you know. Well, I was a young man, I used to do things like this, but when I got older, I ceased to be interested in anything. Or you're saying something about Russia shouldn't be building all these bombs or something and so on. And he'd say, well, when I was young, I used to be interested in this. I mean, as time has gone on, I found out that my goals are simply just to get along, you know, from day to day, and I can't do anything about that sort of thing. And so I, of course, am not interested really in the scene, you see, and so on. And I don't know why you are, actually, either. I'm setting you a good example by withholding myself utterly and never getting anything done, and being a ready bore to everybody, so I don't see why you shouldn't be too, because you probably can't trust yourself either. You know, that's kind of a rationale. Well, you look over existence, and you find out that it's studded with this type of person. Now, what do you think the actual doingness of that person is going to be? It's going to be very, very low. Well, of course, now he has the basic goal of nirvana, of somehow or another mixing with a whole bunch of other identities or entities that will restrain him forevermore, and he won't have to restrain himself anymore, and he'll just sort of mix into this huge Thetan stew pot. and there he is in nirvana, and everything is fine. So one of his ideas is that the highest peak of existence would be able to sit forever on some mountaintop getting frostbitten and not noticing it. And regarding one's navel, I don't know what the attraction of a navel is. Probably has some vast umbilical connotation, but I'm not aware of that. But he does. He gets into this idea that a navel, that's the thing, you know. And then, of course, if he's looking in at his navel, then he knows damn well he's not going to see anything else, so he now knows what he's going to do. He's got a stable datum. He's going to regard his navel, and that's it. That he's got is a stable datum. So, of course, he no longer has to restrain himself. You see? So that's clear. You get how he gets to that step by step. Finally, you get to clear. Clear is totally inactive, totally serene, totally with hell, and isn't any trouble to anybody. And that isn't what a clear is. And the horrible glassy trick of the whole thing is, of course, a clear, more and more able to trust others, partially because he can control them. And more able to trust himself, of course, goes into a higher and higher communication line, and then he's more and more positive about what he's doing. He's not always right, by the way, but he's certainly certain. And he's more right than he would have been before, but he goes further, he can reach further and further. Of course, he gets more and more done, he gets more and more active, he gets more and more enthused and excited, and he likes the existence, and he goes into motion. And then when he's gone through this band of motion, he can go out to the other side, and he either is in motion or is not in motion at his own choice. You know, and his motions are predictable even to himself, and so he's quite trustworthy as far as others are concerned. He's not going to do something weird as far as they're concerned. And they gradually realize they can trust this fellow even though he's in motion, but it takes a little getting used to. I've seen a whole staff go from a clear. You know, oh, we don't know whether that's even. Look at that person, he's doing as much work as five of us, you know. That kind of a reaction. You're not quite sure that this is the right thing because of this other idea that they can't trust themselves, so therefore they ought to be sitting further and further back, doing less and less until they get down to a total contemplation of the umbilical fragment. And that's it. And you see how the goals diverge. Actually, probably only a clear could sit on a mountaintop with the frostbite nibbling in all directions and actually sit there and mock up enough of an umbilical nub to contemplate. He's probably the only one who could actually do that. But this isn't all he does, you get the idea? How people's thinking narrow down on this sort of thing. The ambition very often on a part of a PC, when you get a PC running through goals assessment, will be to become less and less active. You just read the goals. To become less and less active. They announce active goals with regret. Or they belittle them, you know, not as well. When I was 4 or 5, you know, that's standard Anglo-Saxon belittling. You see, 4 or 5, that's supposed to be stupid or something. And when I was 4 or 5, I had this goal to be a cowboy. Nonsense, you know. Try to flatten it. cowboy. I had one who had an offbeat goal that was 4 or 5, and I got to plunging into it a little bit further. Boy, this was the goal. But at first it was just, you know, make nothing out of it. But it was a goal of action. And they start by apologizing for these action goals and rather tending to deify the inaction goals. To be calmly in control of myself in the face of any emergency. And they think doing anything about any emergency. The guy's going to be in control of himself while the emergency is knocking everybody else's head off. But that will be a very laudable goal. Extremely laudable. That'll be a fine thing to do. You just listen to it sometimes. Listen to somebody when he's giving you goals, and listen to his difference of regard for these goals as represented by his tone of voice. You'll learn quite a bit. If the fellow's stress is on goals of inaction, you've got immediate case gauge. See, if they're all inaction goals, if he's kidding all of the action goals, or doesn't give you any action goals at all, and he's tending to deify, you see, all of the inaction goals, why, you've got an idea of what you're bucking into here. You're bucking into fantastic quantities of not know. That's the first index you've got. And you also, if the person's total action goals were all excluded, and he never gave you an action goal of any kind, not even to kid one, you know. Well, don't turn in your thetan, but the sooner you start on this case with not knowing, forgetting, so what you can expect this case that from one day to the next will give you the same goals over again because he doesn't remember what goals he gave you yesterday. You know, inaction, that is the thing. The fellow is getting down to where he is one stable datum as an island in a total confusion. But the stable datum keeps occluding. So it leaves the island of confusion. Now, there are two ways a person could get out of the porridge. And the first way he could get out of the porridge has been the only way he had. That is, kick up the bucket and put on another body. See, that's how he got out of the porridge. So you have enormous amounts of sickness around, because sickness is a covert effort to die, and it is nothing else. Now, death was an ultimate in inaction, and that is why the covert effort to die leads in that direction. So you've got inaction. Inaction leads toward death. That is the destination of inaction. All right, but he could die, so this was the solution. And his efforts to become less active would wind up in death. Now, there was another part of this. If he could become familiar enough with any activity through the process of living, he would wind up with something resembling a rehabilitation of his action. The process of living could refamiliarize him with the zones of action, and so he himself would again go into action. And that process basically took place on the basis of a cycle, which would be the matter of, oh, I don't know, doesn't matter, I can't tell you offhand from PC to PC, it probably varies wildly, but a cycle might be anything from 50,000 years to 2 or 3 billion. You get the order. I'm just trying to give you the order of magnitude. This fellow isn't trying to become familiar with action over a period of one lifetime. See, he's trying to become familiar with a pattern of action over a period of 50,000 years. And then he feels he would be out of the soup at the end of that time. It's kind of a little planned action. And you every once in a while run into a PC who's telling you that it takes some livingness, too. You ever hear a PC say that? That's what he's talking about. He's talking about this cycle of action thing. Of course, he's talking, it doesn't take a little livingness, too. You see, that's not correct. Auditing is a total substitute. But he's got this other program so well aligned, whereby a little more familiarization with action, a little more familiarization, and eventually he will be back in the swing of it again. That's his hope and goal. And that is over some vast period of time. It'll be, oh, vast. I hardly dare even make a guess at it from PC to PC, but take it anywhere between 50,000 years and a billion. And he knows he'll make it sooner or later. He'll get back to those airplanes. Now, when you found a goal of this character that he's actually trying to execute over one of those long cycles, that is the goal that sticks and that you will eventually find yourself running. That's the source of stick of a goal. Is the person is trying to get back into action to achieve this particular goal. And you'll find it's a very uncertain progress in this particular direction, but a tremendously positive goal. Well, it itself could, of course, be traced back to the exact activity he has left, which has become too much for him. In other words, he's got a goal to be a flyer because he can't confront being a flyer. See, he cannot confront any part of being a flyer. He can't confront any part of the track when he was a flyer. He can confront none of the scenes in which he was a flyer, but he has the goal to be a flyer. That's one of these circular goals. It comes right back to itself. And he very often, if he has this very consistently, will be plotting it out across some vast section of time, some enormous section of time. And he will tell you very often, well, it takes livingness, you know, and you have to do some livingness too. And clearing, you know, has to do also with livingness. And he'll give you big arguments along this particular line, okay? Because that's his program. That's a little private program he has. And you find yourself plowing into a goal like that, you'll trace it back to the very goal that it is, you see? And then fall out of that, you will find out what zone he was escaping from by becoming a flyer. And up until the time you've got the flyer out of the road, you don't get to the bottom of the plane. See? The reason he wanted to be a flyer is he's on this planet that was nothing but mud, you see. And it was mud from there on down. It's the original planet the Indian priests had lined up. And it's this mud planet, so he says, well, the only way you can get off the thing, you can become a flyer. You know, every place you walk, it goes squish between your claws. And every time you sit down, you're damp. And he says, to hell with this racket. He didn't want anything to do with it, so he wanted to become a flyer. So after you've cleaned up this whole long cycle goal, you see, by auditing, you wonder why this thing may be hanging up or sticking up, and you apparently have the goal flat, but the person isn't clear, and you can't quite find any other goal. Just look under it. Well, why did you want to become a flyer? That's the way you check out one of these goals that you flattened with the pre-half scale. If it stuck, that would be what you would do. You're not making much progress with this goal, and yet the goal itself doesn't seem to be worrying him anymore. Well, how come he went into this goal in the first place? And we'll find ourselves with a brand new case on our hands. And we'll find ourselves with a vast area of occlusion suddenly laid to view. And you lay into that McDuff with forget and not know and so on, and suddenly he comes up with a brand new series of goals and so on. Quite interesting. Quite interesting to watch this cyclic behavior. So that a case, you might say, goes in swoops. And the swoops are out of what they wouldn't confront. And you very often have to run the swoop itself. And having run the swoop, well, find out what they were swooping out of. Now you'll find you've got a brand new strata of case. And you're liable to get into that particular strata with the protest I described earlier in the lecture. You know, well, I want nothing to do with that. This is why the case is grinding forever. He wants nothing to do with the basis that lies just under it. He begins to feel he's walking on quicksand. If he gets audited just one more session, perhaps, he might go through the volcanic crust into the ashes of the long dead yesterdays. That would be tragic. He'd get clear. But do you know that you will also find PCs doing this and going into this sort of an activity? They will tell you very often, I would rather not be clear than have to face that. If it means that I have to run through that to be clear, then I just won't be clear. That's it. You can run into this. And at this point, the auditor's horsepower has to be applied. Has to be applied. You're running on practically nothing but auditor determination because, of course, you've got the PC in an area of total no determination as far as the PC is concerned. He just wants to escape. He hasn't escaped. He's sitting right in it. So you have to apply the horsepower at this point. Now, any time on the prehab run of clearing that you find a person slogging, slog, 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 he is probably hovering over in small vol planes, hopefully, but you won't notice that if he lands, he'll go straight through the volcanic crust. Got the idea? He's sort of keeping it arduously in the air. And I think grind in clearing, in auditing, the fact the PC just keeps grinds, you see, he just keeps grinding and he keeps grinding and so forth. And he goes on and doesn't seem to be getting any place. It means the fact that you're actually now running the escape. You're running nothing but the escape, and you're running it for something else. And it's something else has come into view, and you haven't seen it yet. And it's been in view for some time. And the PC had the goal to be a flyer. And he goes on running, be a flyer. He runs it on the prehab scale. It's getting less and less, and it's sort of grinding out, and it isn't really getting any place, and the levels flatten off fairly easily, and so on. But it's just, you just keep on running it, and you keep on running it, and you keep on running it. Well, good God, it's about time you did another assessment, isn't it? And find out that there's a whole mud planet sitting there. The one thing he doesn't want to be is an inhabitant of a mud planet. Well, you've still got the mud planet when you clear off the top goal if you go on a grind with the PC, you got it? And I think you'll find that is more or less the basic anatomy that you're running into on long-term clearing. A fellow, you've gotten the swoop out of what he won't be in. and you're running the swoop, and you just keep running this and running this and running this and running this and running this, and you never notice the mud planet. And of course, the PC is actually only too willing to run the swoop. Only too willing, because right there, just 100 feet under the lowest part of the vol plane, you see, is this unending sea of mud, which squishes up between your claws and ruins you every time you sit down. All goals are an escape. All clearing depends on not cutting off all escapes, but on refamiliarizing the person with those things from which he's trying to escape. And I think you'll find clearing goes faster if you apply that law. Refamiliarize the person with the areas from which he is seeking to escape. Of course, for a little while, you're liable to find this awful muddy. PC can go in over his head on this rather easily and get very nervous about it all, and so on. But if in the assessment itself you're lucky enough to find these areas from which they're trying to escape, you're going to wipe out all of the goals that the person has set up in front of you. The person has given you 396 goals, and you've been nulling them very easily, and you get down to goal 80, and this is the third time through, and you're at goal 80, and the third time through, and this suddenly strikes you one way or the other, this unlikely goal, and you say, well, what would that get a man out of, you know? What would that get a person out of one way or the other? And that's easy, but of course you're not going to get me into that. You get this kind of a reaction of that character, cut it to pieces, because you'll find your 386 goals or 83 goals all blown up in your face. You've got a brand new case as soon as you've handled the zone. Got it? Goals are the mechanism of escape, the looking at the invisibilities and hope of the future, and never regarding any part of the liabilities of the present or the horrors of the past. And of course, you can Q&A with this 100%. You can only let the PC look at the beauties of the future. Only the beauties of the future. Of course, they don't erase. Why? Because they haven't happened. No, right back of all of these escapes, of course, were the areas he was trying to escape from. You'll find somebody saying sometime, well, I want to be the Lord Mayor of London once on the back track. I can remember it very vividly. I want to be the Lord Mayor of London. And you put that down, you try to erase Lord Mayor of London, you know, Lord Mayor of London, Lord Mayor of London. Let it strike your mind. Why did he want to be Lord Mayor of London? This ferociously, it is there with ferocity, you know. I mean, it just doesn't erase easily. There it is, Lord Mayor of London. And you say, well, what would the position of Lord Mayor of London get you out of? Of course, the obvious answer is Wormwood Scrubs. It's the only something of this sort. You get a lot of hem and haw, though, before you're liable to get Wormwood Scrubs. Well, it'd get you out of leading a boring life, and it would get you out of this and get you out of that. And was there anything there to get you out of that you'd hate to be in? Well, we're not going to take that up. This is gentleman's agreement, and we've been very quiet in the session so far. Well, what would it be? Well, the Lord Mayor of London at that time was the only one who had the right of signing a pardon for somebody in Newgate. Newgate? What's with Newgate? Well, Newgate, well, now that's something else again. You really want to know. What you really want to know about Newgate? Well, we could start in with the jail fever, of course, but it's actually the straw. It's actually the straw and molders, you know, and there were no toilet facilities at all, so they just threw in more straw and so on. And then there's the rats and so on, and they say, well, you don't want to know anything about that. No, let's get on with this. Let's get on with something pleasant like a goals assessment. And you say, well, what might you have forgotten about Newgate? Wow. Yeah. You're not going to catch me, you know. You're not going to get me running that. If you can strike one of those, you'll change the case just like that. So prospect some. And out of all the vast gray seas of granite, you might find some little pieces of mica, which, when picked up, turn into solid gold. Okay?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.